This week on Family Anatomy, Anatomy of Sex Ed.
The hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologists. So if you want to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you can get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spizzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. And we're going to be talking about sexuality education today, not even sex education.
Sexuality.
We used to say sex ed.
Sex ed is the short form, but I guess a lot of times they're saying sexuality education because they want to broaden our understanding of what they're going to be teaching. It's not just going to be physiological parts that come together.
This must be a fairly recent thing because when I was at school, the extent of sex ed was the physiology, I think, more than anything else. I don't remember learning anything else.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing. I'm doing the research for the show, and I find that on average, kids today get about 7 hours of sex education in their schooling.
In their entire from
in their school,
wow.
Yes, but on average, seven. Now, it could average might be that there's definitely some places. This is U.S. research. Mm-hmm. There's definitely some places that have no sex education. And then there's going to be other states where there's quite a bit more than seven. So, but on average, 7 hours.
Now, I have a hazy memory of this, and I think I was in grade 7 at the time, so I would have been 12, 13 years old. And if I'm not mistaken, our sex ed course was taught by the shop teacher.
Right.
Who separated the boys from the girls.
Right.
And whose opening line was, "No giggling." No giggling.
Which immediately wants to make you giggle more.
Well, right away, right?
Right.
And we got that brief lecture, and that's all I remember. Now, I was 12 or 13 years old, and I never heard about that stuff again when I was 14 or 15 or 16 or 17 or 18 or 19. That's all I heard.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, I didn't get sexuality education. What I got was physiology.
Yeah, and I think it was pretty much how a baby is made, I think, was the extent of it at school anyway.
Yeah, and like I said, very brief, and that was in my teen years. I was curious about it, obviously, and most kids, we should say, are going to be curious about it long before they're teenagers.
Did you have the birds and the bees talk with your parents?
Yes. My father was into nature, so he told me about bees and how they make honey.
Right.
And he told me about how birds like to fly.
That's good.
But,
Those are important things to know.
That's all I got.
Your parents didn't tell you about sex?
Nothing. Hmm. Absolutely nothing. The only time I got anything from a member of my family trying to explain sex to me was my older cousin. And
how much older was your cousin?
She was like only 5 years older.
Older cousin taught you about sex.
Well, wait till you hear what she said.
Oh no. How old were you, first of all? She was 5 years older.
I was probably 6, and so she was 11. You know.
Ooh.
And she told me, I'm going to tell you about the birds and the bees.
Okay.
And I said, okay, well, tell me. I really want to know. And she said, well, bees make babies and birds make babies.
Yeah, okay.
That was that.
That was all you learned.
That was it.
That's good to know.
Yep.
Yeah, she could have looked that up on Wikipedia. You would have got more information.
Yeah, so that was it. I did not get any instruction whatsoever. Anything I ever knew about sex was through practice.
Okay. Yes. All right. And this is a family show, so we're not going to go into too many details about that.
We How about had, you? So you're, you, I didn't get it from school. Did you get it from anywhere else?
Well, my mom was a nurse when I was younger, and we had a set of encyclopedias that was all kinds of things were in there. But there was a certain set of books that was more about the sexuality thing. And so I was, when I was old enough to understand that stuff,
And your parents were in bed?
No. I had a little bit more of a birds and the bees talk, I guess, than you did.
Okay.
And we had a whole bunch of information about dating and all, like, it wasn't just about the physiology in those books. Like I said, it was a set of encyclopedias, almost like a row of books about all the different things that changes that happen in your body, and the physiology part was there, and dating and pregnancy,
so your mother
and all
had
that
a,
stuff.
A series of sex encyclopedias. Is that what you were saying?
Well, I wouldn't put it in those. My mother is probably listening right now, but no, she had some books that were really meant to teach young adolescents, I think, about the sexuality stuff that we're learning at school, like, or that we, maybe they should, that kids should be learning about at school.
Isn't that what I said?
I don't think so. I don't think. Okay. I think you simplified it a little bit too much. Sorry, Mom.
Anyway, so now we have little kids, and you can see they're curious about their bodies. They, you know, they want to know what these things are, and I think, you know, we need to say that it's normal to be curious real young, like 3 and 4 or 5 years old, that you're curious about your own body parts as a child. You're curious about your friends or your girlfriend's or your boyfriend's body parts as well.
Yeah. And, you know, we're limited in some ways, the two of us, because, I mean, among our four kids, they're all four of them are boys. So we have young kids, they're all boys. So I don't know what a young girl's experience is, or what parents of young girls go through with that curiosity piece. But certainly, you know, I can say from experience that boys have questions.
Boys, and you know, I hear my son talk about what they talk about in the schoolyard. And it's not just boys that are involved. There's girls involved as well.
And part of the issue here is that our kids go out to school and they're in a classroom with a whole bunch of other kids. That's fine. Those are other kids their age, and they're at probably the same level of curiosity, likely, and the same level of knowledge, probably. But a lot of kids at school have older brothers or older sisters who, like your older cousin did, maybe gives them some information that they may or may not fully understand. And that gets passed on, and it becomes like a game of telephone from one to the other, until you get very young kids with very strange ideas about what sex is.
Right. Are you gonna expand?
Well, I don't have. I'm trying to think of a specific example, but kids don't understand how babies are made, and so you get weird stories about where the baby in the mummy's tummy comes from, and it doesn't necessarily involve the body parts that we learned about when we were 12 and 13 years old at.
Okay, now some of those weird explanations come from parents. I remember, I don't know if when you were growing up, if they talked about the stork.
You know, I think the first time I heard the stork story was, I think it was explained to me when the stork was in an episode of Bugs Bunny. You know, there were a few Bugs Bunny episodes where the stork would get
the stork, but I mean,
would get mixed up. And
my earliest thing was not the stork from my parents. It was. Where did my sister come from? You know, and they'd say, we bought her at the store. Bought her at the store.
Yeah.
Yeah, where we bought you.
Well.
At the store.
And we can return you. And I mean, we still have the receipt.
We have the receipt.
We can return you at any time. They have a very good return policy at that baby store.
That's right. Like, and most of what's happening with kids when they're curious is completely innocent. You might want to set some limits on what they're doing when they're exploring, but for the most part, they're not going to be engaging in adult sexual activity. So, you know, that's not what's happening there.
No, that's true. But even at a young age, they are, like you said, they're going to be curious, and they may be getting misinformation from Well, who knows? They may not. They may misunderstand things that they see on television or things that they hear in music or on the radio or on the playground. And so that curiosity may be sated in ways that we wouldn't even have any idea what our kids know. I haven't sat down with my kids to ask them, honestly. No. Okay, what have you heard? I have overheard some very harmless, mind you, but I have overheard some misinformation. I think at birthday parties or sleepovers and things like that, I've heard some talk that was a little bit out there, but I haven't been asked about it to correct.
I've heard conversations that my son tells me from the playground, like so and so showed so and so their bum, so and so showed so and so their blank. You know,
wow,
that's right. So
schools in the city, I never in my little country one room schoolhouse, I never hear about those kinds of things.
Well, keep your ears open. That's
all. Maybe I'm not listening.
It's worse in the country.
Yeah, you think so? Eh?
Sure.
Well, now, it's possible.
A little bit of history. Contraception.
Ooh.
Right? You'd think that, when you think about it, you think contraception is something that, the pill was first invented in the early 60s. So that's recent history, really. But contraception, like condoms, are ways to keep a woman from becoming pregnant, have been around for centuries. Some of the things, now this is just for interest's sake, some of the things that they used to use as barriers.
Oh boy.
Lemon juice. Essence from mahogany husks.
Okay.
You've used that.
Absolutely. Essence. I don't even...
It's the essence.
I have questions about what is the essence.
How, just the essence.
How could this be used?
Oil of cedar.
Okay.
And frankincense and olive oil.
Hmm.
Wow, that sounds like it's going back to biblical times.
Wow. Gold and myrrh.
Yep.
What was going
Cabbage.
On in that...
Now, I know you've used that one.
Will you stop?
And willow leaves. What do you got?
Onion juice,
peppermint oil, and so. Now they're thinking that there's some of these things are quite acidic or alkaline, and that they might actually have afforded some degree of protection.
I'm sure there are a lot of babies running, a lot of unexpected babies running around.
Quite a few babies as well.
No
yeah.
question about it.
So, but sex education in schools, because obviously through centuries, parents have had to deal with the growing sexuality, like I said, and even very early on of their children. So, but up until a century ago, it was all their responsibility, parents' responsibility. Then about a century ago, they decided that schools would start to try and teach some sex education.
And that's a controversial one.
And then it gets controversial because, and we understand this more recently as being that there's people that are afraid that if you teach sex education at school, that it'll make it more likely that your teen will go out and have sex.
They'll want to experiment.
They'll know more, and they'll want to do it as a result of you teaching them about it.
There was a good episode of King of the Hill when Peggy Hill, the substitute teacher, became a sex ed teacher for a little while, and okay. that was quite controversial. She was almost driven out of town.
Oh, yeah.
She was getting threatening phone calls and things thrown through the window because she was going to teach kids about sexuality.
Wow. Yeah. Now, there's a completely opposite point of view, a more progressive point of view that... Well, first of all, we should say that there's a lot of people that don't want sex to be taught, but they do want abstinence to be taught,
mm-hmm.
right? So, there's programs that are built around that. And I think over the past decade in the U.S., about $50 million a year was given out by the federal government to the states.
To abstinence-only programs.
For abstinence-only education programs. Now, they could mention condoms, but only in the context of their failure rates.
Right. And we've seen statistics that many of those programs overestimate the failure rates of condoms and really downplay any benefits that condoms might have. But now, I've never been involved in that kind. Like our sex ed program was, maybe it was brief, but at least we learned about the physiology and things like that. Do abstinence only programs teach even that part of it? Or what exactly are they teaching? Do the kids in those programs know what sex is?
Well, this is the thing, you know, there's places, like I think in the Netherlands, where the sex education is standardized. So everybody in the Netherlands gets the same message, which is, you know, considered from North American standpoint, probably more of a permissive or progressive message, let's say.
Okay. Right? So they learn about contraception and things like that.
They learn about the whole gamut, and not just contraception, but in the larger view too. Love, relationships, sexuality, sexual orientation, masturbation. You know, they learn the full scope of what it is to be a sexual being.
And these are things, I think, that if you limit the idea of what you're going to teach your kids about sex to that birds and the bees, to that sex talk, I think that's a pretty scary thing for parents, right? It can be, you can feel nervous and uncomfortable, and you just wind up procrastinating and putting it off because you think you're going to have this big talk. But this program in the Netherlands isn't just teaching that one. It's not about just one lecture. It's a whole range of different things. And it's not just about the sex act. It's about relationships. And it sounds like even the consequences and responsibilities that go along with an intimate sexual kind of a relationship.
Absolutely. And along with that, abstinence as well. Like, it's not, they're not a separate sort of things that can't be discussed in the same discussion. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can still talk about abstinence and waiting until you feel right and so on. But you also, if that's your choice, right? But you also talk about some of the realities, you know? So because what you have really is 34, here's some statistics. 34% of adolescents report having had intercourse by grade 9.
Grade 9. So that's 14, 15 years old.
Yeah.
Right? Wow. That's a third of kids by the time they're 15.
14, even.
14,
right?
Yeah.
14
yeah,
years
yeah,
old.
Could be.
A third of kids by the time they're 14. 63%, or let's say two-thirds of kids by the time they're in grade 12, 17 years old.
In high school, yeah.
So parents need to be ahead of the curve, and they need to be realistic, right? So if you know that you're 14, there's a one in three chance that your kid is going to be having sex by the time they're 14, and you wait for them to be 14.
Well, that's true, but parents are going to say, it's human nature. Well, not my kid. My kid's not going to be one of those two-thirds. My kid will be the one-third that doesn't do that because I'm teaching them these values and they've learned about abstinence or they've taken the abstinence pledge or what have you. Do those abstinence-only programs, are they related to a reduction? We're all about on Family Anatomy, about the research and what that tells us.
Let's get into it.
What are the statistics on these
things? Here's the research on this. So, abstinence-only education, they've researched it. What do they find? They find that, yes, it does influence your attitudes. So, you on a questionnaire, it's going to come out that if you've gone through one of these programs, you have a greater intention to remain abstinent, and you have a greater perceived understanding of the consequences of premarital sex. So your attitudes are different. The problem is your behavior is no different from the person who didn't have that education.
Wow.
So there's a big difference between, yeah, you might have a different attitude, but boy, it just goes to show you how powerful this growing sexual feeling and this sexual person that's developing, and you know, quite frankly, we know from brain development that they don't have the same sort of impulse control,
planning, decision making abilities.
Exactly, right? So, I mean, there is a legitimate fear there as well, but that fear is not going to be helped with abstinence only education.
And in fact, I remember back when we were writing and talking about memory for a week when we talked to Dr. Loftus. And one of the things that I looked at was this idea of the abstinence pledges that people are starting to take now, I think often in schools in the States, those little groups that get together and they have these they pledge that they're going to remain celibate until they're married or what have you. And research was showing that 2 years later, most of those students didn't remember ever having taken that pledge. So it didn't change their behavior at all.
No. And the research just continues to show that You can change the attitudes, but not so much the actual behavior.
So teaching values is worthwhile in terms of passing on those attitudes to your children, that it's important to be abstinent, for example. If
right,
that's now, what you believe, that teaching abstinence is something that's important to you, that can have an impact on your child's values, but it won't necessarily change their behavior, which is the key.
Which is the key for the parents, I think, who are that concerned about the abstinence.
Well, I think right? for any parent, you want your kids to be careful.
Right, but if all they thought was, I'll change your attitude, but they're still going to do it, they'd be disappointed.
Right.
Right?
So what about the other kinds of programs, the broader programs that, like the Norwegian one, that describes all of the information?
Well, let's look at one statistic here. There's a DiCenzo study. I think that's what it is.
DiCenzo.
I should know how to say that.
You should know how to say that. You bragged about it when we talked about that other guy last week.
Interventions to reduce unintended pregnancies among adolescents. Systematic review of randomized controlled trials. British Medical Journal, 2002 study.
Okay, so what this means is that these guys went through a whole bunch of studies that had been done, randomized control studies, meaning that they had different groups and they set things up where certain kids would follow a certain kind of a program. So he's taking a whole bunch of those and looking over to see how well they work.
So they looked at these abstinence-only programs, and they looked at the United States, England and Wales, Canada and Belgium.
Okay.
And they concluded that countries with more liberal policies or more progressive policies towards sex education had lower rates of teen pregnancy.
Oh, okay.
So the more kids were learning about, the less likely. Well, the more they were learning about something comprehensive, the less likely they were to have teen pregnancies, really, if you look at it. 93 in 1,000 is the rate of pregnancy in the U.S.
Okay.
62 out of 1,000 in England and Wales, 42 out of 1,000 in Canada, and 15 out of 1,000 in Belgium.
In Belgium?
Yeah.
What are they teaching in Belgium?
So there you go.
I want to know how the Flemish do this.
Yes.
What is that program all about?
So we've been talking about how there's this dichotomy and this controversy, but really, here's the other thing. Surveys show, I feel like a talk show host.
Family Feud, Survey Says.
That's right. Sorry, not a game show host.
Exactly.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, game show host. Yeah. Survey says that 89% of people, this was a study in Minnesota,
okay.
by the way.
Sure.
89% of parents were in agreement with teaching sex education to their kids. And usually it's like grade 7 and 8 that they start.
Okay.
89%, meaning 11% were not in favor. That 11% is a really strong vocal minority that
can
really change things around in terms of what happens.
They're boycotting and protesting and things like that. So that's it.
And
so they're controlling the political agenda a little bit more than the 89% are.
And so what they found is instead of having this dichotomy of let's teach about condoms or let's teach about contraception or not or let's teach just about abstinence, you can have what they've come to call comprehensive sexuality education.
And that includes information about puberty and STDs and teen pregnancy, those the responsibilities and consequences of being sexually active, right? Not just, and talking about relationships and dating and all of those kinds of things as well. So not just one little piece. It's not just about sex ed, it's about sexuality education.
That's why they're saying it that way.
And I really believe, like we talked earlier, we were in grade 7, so we were 12 or 13 years old when they gave us our 7 hours or however long we had to study this stuff. But it needs to be an ongoing thing too. As teenagers, you need to get the information at the time that you need it, or else it's not going to be fresh in your mind. You're not going to remember it or think about it at the time when these situations are becoming more common.
This is maybe a way you want to think about it. Like we were saying earlier, this can start really young. You got a 3, a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, they're in the bathtub. They might ask about it. And you need to be prepared to tell a kind of a straightforward factual answer. in response.
I think being prepared, and I know we've talked about being prepared and planning ahead and things like that before, but I think being prepared is key, because this may not be, especially as the kids get older, this may not be the most comfortable conversation you're ever going to have with your child.
Not only won't it be the most comfortable conversation, but as they get older, if you wait until they're in their teen years, they're less likely to come to you to ask, because they're individuating, they want to be their own person, they're separating from you in some ways and redefining their relationship with you. You know, you want to, like I say, it's going to be all through the years and everyday things, especially when they're really young and you know, that you have these opportunities. You want to be reactive when they're real young, maybe, and then more proactive as they get older.
The fact is, you and I both know, the longer you avoid something you're nervous about, the bigger a deal that thing becomes, the more anxious you become about facing that thing eventually. And the longer you put it off, the more likely your kids are going to get the information from someone else, which may or may not be the information that you want them to get. So you do need to plan ahead. I think we know as psychologists, ages ago, there was something that changed a little bit in the area of psychology and psychiatry in Canada, at least. I don't know if they follow the same kinds of rules in the States, but we're required, if someone tells us that they're going to hurt themselves or hurt somebody else, for example, if someone comes into our office and talks about child abuse, legally, these are things that we have to report. And when these laws first kind of came into the books, psychologists became worried that nobody would ever want to talk to them because everything wasn't private. There wasn't the same level of doctor-client confidentiality, if you want to call it that, that there was before. And what the research showed at that time was that the more comfortable the psychologist was having that discussion with their client, the calmer that they could be in that discussion, the more the client was going to accept those rules and be okay with it. Whereas the more, if you're really nervous and defensive about it, then your client is going to feel less comfortable about it too. I would say it's the same thing with as a parent talking to your kids. The more nervous and uncomfortable you are, the more nervous and uncomfortable they're going to be in talking to you about it. And at the end of the day, you need them to talk to you about it if you want to pass on your values and share what's important to you.
And again, I think we've mentioned this in other shows that when they start becoming sexually active, if they know that there's some open communication with you and they're confused about how they feel, about what they've done, about feelings that they have, good or bad, they're much more likely to come over to you when they feel they have permission. And part of that permission is that you felt comfortable over the years, because it's not, because you see this,
all of a
it's
sudden,
a bit of a stereotype. Eh? You see it in movies or you hear them talk. Did you have the talk yet? Like, it's this one-time shot. And a lot of times it's also made a joke of, like, the parent goes into the, you know, the 15 or 16-year-old to talk and they already know everything. And it's,
well, let me tell you, that's not just a joke. I was looking at some research on the birds and the bees talk, and some of the research is showing that that's kind of a dangerous term because it couches it in that one discussion that you're going to have and you're never going to talk about it again. It makes it scarier for the parents, for sure. But they found that boys were more likely to say that they were more comfortable talking to their dad about sexual things. If they were going to talk to anybody, they were more comfortable. Boys were more comfortable talking to their dad. But then when they talked to the dads about what the discussion was, it was jokes. It was exchanging sexual insults, silence. It wasn't a talk at all, really, when you break it down and really look at what they're talking about. But this is an important discussion, and I think moms and dads both need to think about being open and comfortable as much as they possibly can, and in fact, even being honest about their discomfort if it's there. You know, this is a bit scary for me too.
And again, I think if you just reduce it down to sexual intercourse, that's where it sort of it makes it more sort of intense and uncomfortable. It needs to be in this broader context. You know, your son or daughter might be starting to date. There's much more there than just the sexual intercourse. How do you feel about this person? What's happening in your relationship? Are you having any different new feelings? Do you want to talk about it? It's more than that one act.
And it is important to be honest in an age-appropriate way, to respond to your kids' questions, but you kind of need to think about what are you going to say ahead of time, and that's not the easiest thing to do. I'm going to have to sit down and talk with my wife about how are we going to respond when those questions... No, we have had some questions that we've talked to the kids about, but you know there's going to be more of those kinds of things. The American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry had some suggestions for parents for about talking to their kids about sex and sexuality. Encourage your child to talk and ask questions. Maintain a calm atmosphere for discussions. Use words that are understandable. Try to find out what your child's level of knowledge is, how much they understand, even, is good. Keep your sense of humor, which is maybe not easy to do in those situations.
Yep.
Relate sex to love, intimacy, caring, respect for yourself and one's partner. Be open in sharing your values and sharing your concerns. Talk about the importance of responsibility for your choices and help your child to remember pros and cons of choices in general, maybe not just the sexual kinds of or dating choices that you make. So I thought those are kind of a good rundown of some of the things that parents might want to consider. That brings us to our top three things.
Let's do it.
Well, the number one thing is that kids' curiosity about sex and sexuality certainly starts early. This is an ongoing discussion for parents, for sure. It's not just one talk about the birds and the bees. In fact, in some ways, that idea is dangerous because it becomes such a scary big deal for parents that they wind up putting it off until their kids have already gotten probably misinformation from their friends at school. So this is a conversation that I think it's important to have, and it's not just one discussion, it's an ongoing one.
And the number two thing to remember is that not talking about sex with your kids or hoping that abstinence education will keep them from having sex is going to fail 1/3 of the time for 14-year-olds, 2/3 of the time for 17-year-olds. And really, comprehensive sex education is something that most parents want. They should be asking their school boards for, and it's endorsed by... There's a long list of American Psychological Association, American Medical Association, National Association of School Psychologists, Academy, American Academy of Pediatrics. You know, it's a long list, and it's the way to go.
The third thing is, if you're going to have this comprehensive discussion, you need to plan ahead. This may be something that's not comfortable for many parents. You want to think about what you want to say, and maybe especially what you want your kids to know, including their own responsibilities, the consequences of the choices that they make, and your values that are important to you that you hope you're going to be able to pass on to your kids. And that's our top three things, which brings us to the website of the week.
Our website of the week is childrennow.org.
Now, this is a site that it's sort of a special interest group, I guess. It's a U.S., almost like lobbyists, you might say, that are trying to promote to policymakers the importance of the well-being of children.
It's really for children's rights. Eh? They're promoting children's rights, and they're trying to get their needs placed higher on the agenda because... Like, there's far more powerful interest groups than these people, and so this is a good thing they're doing.
Exactly, and one of the neat things, the thing that I really liked about the site, actually, is that there's a section of it that's called Talking with Kids, and the idea is that parents need to talk to their kids before everyone else does. And so they have a number of different topics that, and the message is, encouraging an open communication with kids about some issues that are pretty difficult. And of course, we're talking about sexuality education, and sex and relationships is one of the top ones on that list. There's also drugs and alcohol and things like that, but they have some good ideas, many of the ones that we've talked about, on how parents can talk to their kids about what might be a pretty difficult subject.
That's right. So they're, you know, if you look at their article there, they're talking about explore your own attitudes, get an early start, take the initiative, talk more than just the birds and the bees with your kids, and anticipate the next stage of development, communicate your values, and relax.
One of the things they mention on there is to talk with your child of the opposite sex. So maybe not just to have the mom talk with the daughter and the father talk with the son, but to mix things up a little bit. Just you want your kids to be comfortable talking to you about these things, because you need to know if they have questions or concerns, or they're about to make a decision that might have major consequences for them in the future.
And really, if you think about that part of it, it's speaking to the fact that you don't want to shrink this down to a really reductionistic kind of talk. It's a much broader, it's a much more important experience in life than that. And if you take some of the anxiety around this subject out, you'll see that why wouldn't you have someone from the opposite sex having that conversation? You want them to know as many things as they can about this area of their development.
Well, yeah, I mean, you talk about perspective taking, and you want them to think about how the other person might be feeling or thinking. Well, then having the opposite gender parent come and talk to them might be an important element of that. So we think this is a great site. Childrennow.org is our website of the week.
And that's it for the show. We'd like to thank everyone who's been getting the word out about the show and the website. We really appreciate that. And you can go to our website at familyanatomy.com, or you can email us at info@familyanatomy.com. And as always, Brian has an announcement.
And the announcement once again is that we're coming up on show number 100. 100 episodes of Family Anatomy. I can barely believe it. Every time I think about it, it's hard to imagine that we've been sitting here across from each other almost every week for well over a year. Certainly we've had over 100 get-togethers talking about our own kids and these kinds of issues, but I want to reiterate what you said. Thanks to everybody for sharing our show, our website, our information that we think is really important for parents to know about. Thank you so much for sharing that with your friends, with your family, with anyone else that you think will listen. And you can spread the word by commenting on our website or other sites about the things that we talk about, by voting at podcastalley.com. If you want to send us an email at info@familyanatomy.com to say congratulations for 100 episodes, we welcome that as well. Any way that you can think of to share this information, to get it out there, that brings more people to the site, and it helps us find new websites of the week, new guests to interview. We've really enjoyed We're still enjoying what we're doing. We've enjoyed what we've done so far, and we want to keep doing it into the future. So thank you once again. And as usual, we'll leave you today with a bit of a tune by Brother Love, who's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening. Get up and sing, oh, like we used to do. Yeah, cause it's a family thing. Hey! You know what to do. FamilyAnatomy.com